This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. Geico has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
The giant takeover that begins in November. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
On November 8th, we'll elect a new president, and whoever it is will have 73 days to get up to speed. How efficient is this most important of takeovers?
Also, patients are being asked to make more decisions in the ER, even some tough ones. We'll explain the tools at your disposal.
The growing trend at some bars, religious discussions over beer. Find out what's happening in Milwaukee.
And how your team can avoid a crippling pick in the NFL draft this weekend.
You know, you see all these teams you put in. They put in all these, probably thousands of hours of work between all the people. They're studying game tape. They're putting players through physicals, individual workouts. They're sending investigators to dig into their backgrounds. And then you still see teams make head-scratching picks like drafting Brandon Whedon in the first round.
Ouch. Wall Street Journal reporter Andrew Beaton on how to avoid botching the NFL draft. He's here later in the hour. Well, between early November and lasting through much of January of next year, we're going to be transitioning to a new administration in the White House. For the last 8 years, a collection of government officials, good governance advocates, and lawmakers in Congress have been working to improve presidential transitions. They're trying to buy the new president extra time by ensuring that on November 8th, whoever wins the White House isn't starting from a dead stop. It's a deep dive story by Russell Berman at The Atlantic. Russell set this up.
Well, you know, every 4 or 8 years, the government is handed over from one administration to the next. And traditionally, it's been sort of an ad hoc process. There hasn't been much formal role. This is a 72, 73-day transition between the election and the inauguration, and you're handing over, you know, one of, if not the largest organization in the world, and that has national security implications, obviously. The United States is vulnerable during a period of transition, and from a personnel management process, there's thousands of new positions that have to be filled by the new administration. And so there's been this effort over the years to try to improve that process to make sure that candidates are not starting from a dead stop when they get elected and asking, you know, what now on November 8th when they're taking office in just a few weeks.
All right, so how bad, say, has the transition been in the past? Do we have a history of kind of rough starts?
Yeah, I mean, it sort of, if you go back, basically everybody has had a rough start. I've talked to people who look at this at the Partnership for Public Service, which is a nonprofit in D.C., and they told me it's never really been done right. And you see that from a public perspective with cabinet appointees that are, have to withdraw. They haven't been properly vetted. But you also see it with, look at 2008, which was actually a good transition historically. But you had the Treasury Secretary, Timothy Geithner, in the middle of the economic crisis, and he was sitting basically virtually alone in the Treasury Department because so few of the appointees under him had been confirmed or put in place because it's such a slow process. And so one thing that they want to do is to have these campaigns start thinking before the election about who they're going to possibly appoint so they can get security clearances. And so everything can be done faster and the government could be stood up much earlier in the administration than it has been in the past.
My goodness. We're speaking with Russell Berman, senior associate editor at The Atlantic. He's got a fascinating story entitled The Most Important Takeover of Any Organization in History. And he's got to look at how presidential administrations transfer from one to the other, like one that will come up here in January or November through January. So what's a worst case scenario here? Some sort of a terror attack, for example, this day and age during a transition period?
Well, yeah, and that's another thing that almost happened in 2008. They did do preparations, and so they were ready. But on come the inauguration, when it was going to go from Bush to Obama, there was what was described as a credible threat of a terrorist attack on the National Mall when Obama is giving his inaugural address. And so that morning, you had Josh Bolton, who was the outgoing chief of staff, and Rahm Emanuel, who was the incoming chief of staff, leaving the traditional coffee that the presidents have with their families and going into the Situation Room to prepare for this possibility. Of course, everything worked out fine. But, as Josh Bolton told me, imagine that scenario without any planning. It would have been chaos. And he told me another story of when he, the Bush administration, came into office from the Clinton administration in 2001. 8 months later, obviously, was September 11th, and he's sitting in his desk as a deputy chief of staff. He gets a call on his inside line. It's from his predecessor, Steve Ricchetti, who asks, "Do you know about the bunker?" Because there was so little transition planning that Ricchetti had an assumption or had a thought that they might not even know about that secret command center below the White House that ended up being so crucial in the days and weeks and on the day of 9/11. They did know about the bunker, as it turned out, but just the fact that he was worried that they would not have was an indication of how little institutional transition planning was done at the time.
Corporate managers would have a field day with this, wouldn't they?
Right. This story is of particular interest to them, because you have a lot of, even in the aspect of the outgoing administration, traditionally, people start to leave well before the president does. And so what happens is you have all these agencies that are sort of empty in November and starting really in July, August, September. And so new legislation provides for the administration to name non-political civil servants to basically make sure that all these agencies have leadership in place, at least temporarily, when the government changes over.
Thanks, Russell. Russell Berman at The Atlantic. It's 13 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Give your employees the power to do their best work. Reduce downtime by 50% and boost productivity with 4 times faster performance by updating to the most secure, manageable, and reliable Dell Latitude business class laptops and 2-in-1s with the latest Intel Core processors. Give your employees the power to do their best work. Learn more at Dell.com/radio. That's Dell.com/radio. In the emergency room, you might rightly expect doctors to call all the shots about tests and treatments, but more and more, ER physicians are asking patients to get more involved in critical decisions about care, such as whether to opt for surgery or undergo a scan with radiation exposure. More from This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
When you're an outpatient, you can often participate in the decision-making process about your care. But when you or a loved one is in the ER, things get a little more complicated. Laura Landro of the Wall Street Journal is here to tell us more about some new tools designed to help you make choices in the ER. Laura, why shouldn't doctors make all the calls in the ER?
Well, I mean, I think it's one thing if you're coming in on a stretcher and you've had a heart attack or you're clearly in mortal danger, but most of the people that are coming into the ER are walking in by themselves. They've got pain they can't describe, or they've had, something happen to them. And the diagnosis, once it's made, often leaves open more than one option for treatment. And I think many times people would expect, well, the doctor will just tell me what he's going to do or she's going to do. But in fact, there's more in this whole movement known as patient-centered care. The idea is nothing about me without me. You should be able to actively participate in decisions about your care when you're able to make them.
Which conditions or situations do you think this is best suited for?
Well, again, let's talk about non-life-threatening, what they would call, uncomplicated acute appendicitis. Children walk in with abdominal pain. They're diagnosed with appendicitis. And again, unless they're in a septic situation where it's already burst and they're, being blood poisoning is happening and all these, you know, surgery has to be immediate. In many cases, there's new evidence that shows Nationwide Children's in Columbus, for example, had done some studies that show that in 3 out of 4 kids, the antibiotics instead of surgery were just as effective. And so they would, you know, the idea is to give parents the information about surgery versus antibiotics and let them make the choice and, you know, keep it open that if the antibiotics don't work, we'll probably know that overnight, and then you can still have the surgery. So those are the kind of decision-making tools that are being designed right now. So a parent, family member can sit down, maybe with an iPad, in this case of Nationwide Children's, and go through the iPad, look at the different things, maybe make some input about my preferences, like I work and I really don't want the kid to be in the hospital for, you know, a long time if I don't have to. So there are decision-making aids that actually help with this. So you're not just sort of trying to listen to the doctor and take it all in, which is often people like it goes in one ear and out the other.
You mentioned an iPad. What other kinds of tools are we talking about?
Well, they do these risk calculators where, for example, Mayo Clinic is designing a few of these where there's one called chest pain choice, where you come in and you have an initial few tests after chest pain that indicate you're not having a heart attack. And they'll give you a printout, basically, with all the information that you need and your individual, based on all the factors about you, a calculation of what your risk is of having a heart attack in the next couple of weeks. So it might be, you know, with a pictograph, there's like 100 people and there's like one of them had a heart attack. So they'll give you information like that that really defines risk for you. And then, you know, options, you know, get more tests, go, you know, stay for observation, have an appointment with another doctor within the next 72 hours. And you make a decision about, you know, what you think is best. And in the end, by the way, you can always say to the doctor, you decide what I'm supposed to do, and they will. But I think a lot of people are sort of more interested in information that can help them decide what care they want.
Yeah, Laura, I was just going to ask you that. Are some people kind of confused about the information and feel uncertain about making such decisions?
You know, absolutely. And I think that will always be the case, particularly in an emergency where it's very stressful. But, you know, there's really no evidence at all that this kind of decision-making can't be done in the ER. It's just, you know, the studies have shown it's just the least conducive. And a lot of it is because of doctors' attitudes. They surveyed some doctors and they found that, you know, doctors said things like, well, patients want us to choose. It's too complicated for them. They'll just want to order more tests, you know. So there is sort of a decision hurdle that has to be, you know, overcome in terms of letting doctors, you know, feel comfortable with this. Also, obviously, in medicine, there's always the concern about malpractice litigation. Although it seems that, you know, some of the evidence out there is that people are less likely to be litigious when they've been given a lot of information, when they've reviewed the evidence, and when, you know, they've made what they call a shared decision with the doctor.
This weekend's Jennifer Koschenka with Wall Street Journal health writer Laura Landreau. 21 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. How ready is your state in the event of a natural disaster, like a disease outbreak or a weather emergency? The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation is out with the 2016 National Health Security Preparedness Index, which analyzes the strength of emergency systems around the country, specifically their ability to help protect us. More from Dr. Glenn Mays, researcher from the University of Kentucky. Glenn, what's the index about?
The National Health Security Preparedness Index really tracks how prepared we are as a nation for protecting people's health and safety when there are disasters, health emergencies that strike, whether they're hurricanes, fires, floods, disease outbreaks, what have you.
All right, so how did you break down which state is prepared and which state is not?
Well, we integrate information from lots of different sources. There are more than 130 individual measures that flow into the index, and that are measure preparedness in one of 6 broad domains or activities of preparedness. And we roll those up into scores, scale those measures from a 0 to 10 scale, with 10 higher numbers being more prepared. And then we can use that information to track how prepared the nation is, as well as to track and compare individual states.
So are certain states better prepared than other states at certain things, for example?
Absolutely. Preparedness is not a one-size-fits-all proposition, and states that are very good at some types of activities, like detecting potential health threats early through surveillance, might be weaker on other areas, like how you manage the data, the immediate decision making processes when you're responding to a disaster. So there are, again, lots of elements that go into being prepared and protecting health, and again, some states are stronger in some areas, weaker in others.
All right, so give us some examples here. Who's strong, who's not so strong?
Well, the good news overall as a nation is that we're seeing relatively good scores. The U.S. as a whole reached a preparedness level of 6.7 out of a possible high score of 10, and that number has trended upward by about 3%, a little over 3% over the last 3 years. There are a number of states, a group of about 18 states, that have preparedness levels significantly higher than that overall national level. In fact, the highest overall state in terms of overall preparedness in this last release of the index was Maryland, the state of Maryland.
Interesting. All right, so Maryland, for example, is prepared for, I don't know, what? What are they good at?
Maryland is really strong across the board, a number of dimensions, including some of the early stage activities that we like to see happen before events occur. Again, strong surveillance systems for detecting potential health threats, strong environmental monitoring capabilities in terms of monitoring water quality, air quality, food safety, those activities, as well as strengths in managing and making decisions in the course of a disaster or a health emergency.
How about a state like California, which where it's not uncommon to hear of a minor earthquake or a wildfire, something along those lines?
Absolutely. Each state kind of has its own profile of the types of risks and hazards that they face. And certainly on the West Coast, things like earthquakes and also fires and floods can be big issues. And a large state like California faces a lots of different potential health threats. California actually has looked pretty good as well. They track quite closely with the nation as a whole in terms of overall levels of preparedness. They've improved a little faster than the nation as a whole over the past 3 years, however, especially in the area of community planning and engagement, another very important piece of the preparedness puzzle that we've learned through lots of research and experience over decades, that planning in advance and getting lots of different agencies who need to be involved in preparedness, both in government and the private sector, getting them to plan together and to practice together, very, very important. And California has some real strengths in that area.
Thanks, Glenn. Dr. Glenn Mays, researcher from the University of Kentucky. It's 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Coming up next, how not to screw up the NFL draft. Everyone knows that business is all about numbers. Consider the numbers the state of Michigan can offer your business, like being a top 10 pro-business state, or 2,000, the number of unnecessary regulations Michigan has eliminated in the last 5 years, and 6, Michigan's rank for best entrepreneurial climate, which all adds up to the one state that has all that and more. Michigan. Go to MichiganBusiness.org to learn more. Well, the NFL draft is into its later rounds this weekend. Meanwhile, as NFL teams attempt to navigate their way through this year's draft without shooting themselves in the foot, Wall Street Journal reporter Andrew Beaton has put together a handful of simple rules that teams can follow to avoid the missteps that result in a draft class that can cripple a franchise. Andrew, help us out.
You know, you see all these teams you put in, they put in all these probably thousands of hours of work between all the people. They're studying game tape, they're putting players through physicals, individual workouts, they're sending investigators to dig into their backgrounds. And then you still see teams make head-scratching picks like drafting Brandon Wheaton in the first round. And so we were just looking for some interesting statistical trends about here are some things that you can look for maybe as a fan or see what your team is doing and say, you know, we should like that. There are things like, you know, you never really hear about youth in terms of whether you should draft a player. You hear about that all the time in the NBA draft where you know freshmen are always the hottest prospects every year, but you never really hear a player's age in regards to the NFL draft. But according to our research, actually, the younger players have actually had a much greater rate of making the Pro Bowl when drafted in the first round versus older players drafted in the first round. So things like that about how here's some easy tips that maybe teams should look at or maybe fans can just pay attention to on draft day.
All right, so if it's that easy, how come my New York Jets haven't had a quarterback since roughly 1968?
Well, finding that good quarterback might be the toughest thing around. I mean, just ask the Browns, who done things like draft Brandon Weeden or Johnny Manziel or took Tim Couch with the first overall pick in 1999.
Wow, that's right.
But, you know, one of the interesting things we found out about quarterbacks was that, you know, every NFL general manager dreams of finding the next Tom Brady. You see, you don't see many quarterbacks taken in the middle rounds of the draft, in rounds like 3, 4, and 5, but you see a ton go off in rounds 6 and 7. But those quarterbacks have absolutely no hope of turning into a future star. Tom Brady is the real exception to the rule, but you see all these teams think, all right, this is our penny stock. We're going to go for it. Yeah. But actually, if you look at second-round picks or even third-round picks, they have a decent rate of turning into pretty good players. And Jets fans haven't gotten to see Bryce Petty yet. You brought up the Jets, but they took him pretty high last year, sat him on the bench. So it'll be interesting to see what he turns into down the road.
Yeah. All right, you mentioned, too, don't overlook the small schools. I guess that can be tough, though, given kind of the TV prominence of the big schools.
Yeah, I mean, so here's the thing. If you follow the NFL draft, you've probably heard of Carson Wentz, who's number 2 overall to the Eagles. But if you're the craziest college football fan, you might have never seen Carson Wentz play because he played at North Dakota State,
yeah,
which is an FCS school. But the thing is with these players, they actually have a pretty good rate of turning into good pros.
What was your point, too, about making more trades?
So that actually came from a fascinating study by a couple of Wichita State economics professors who essentially found that when teams trade up to draft a specific player, that player ends up having a better career than teams that retained their pick in that same spot. So essentially, a lot of their numbers boil down to these economic principles about like free markets and whatnot, but it's their idea is that when a player knows it needs a specific guy, they probably have a higher need for that pick than that team that's willing to trade down. So they have a better use for that player or whatever it may be, but they place more value on that pick and with good reason, and that player turns out to have a better career.
Thanks, Andrew. Andrew Beaton, Wall Street Journal reporter. 21 minutes before the hour on This Weekend. Glad you're with us. Here's a question for you. What's wrong with the PC? In part, it's the PC industry itself. So says Rob Enderle, principal at the tech advisory firm, the Enderle Group. Rob, how do you see it?
We've had a decade of reasons why the PC is falling off. We had the Windows Vista problem. We had the Windows 8 problem. We had tablets that were going to take PCs out, and none of those proved to be a sustaining issue, really. Windows Vista was replaced by Windows 7, Windows 8 by Windows 10, which has been relatively popular. And tablets are falling faster than PCs at the moment, so they certainly aren't taking PCs out, and I don't think they ever really were. But after we get all the way through, it's like you have a doctor that says, okay, you're sick. Tell you what, why don't you stop eating gluten, and you stop eating gluten, and you're still sick. It's, well, why don't you stop eating sugar, and you stop eating sugar, and you're still sick. And it's, well, why don't you stop eating beef, and you stop eating beef, and you're still sick. Maybe it's time to stop listening to the doctor and start going back and trying to figure out what's wrong.
All right, so what is it, in your opinion? What's with PCs?
Well, so I looked back at when the PC was in its heyday, and that was in the 1990s. Probably it peaked in about 1995 with Windows 95. And both Intel and Microsoft were closely partnered. There was a lot of money going into PC advertising. We had technology shows all over the place. I mean, much like we have car TV shows now, we had technology and PC TV shows. We had contests of who could build the coolest PC. We had big announcements surrounding PCs that when they came out, almost like new cars. We had lines around the block for Windows 95. All of that activity happened, and then as we got into the 2000s, well, people cut budget on marketing. The TV shows that talked about PCs went away. We don't even really talk about PC mod contests anymore broadly. I don't know the last time somebody's picked up and talked about a group of gamers getting together just to game, even though it does happen quite a bit, and we do have pretty big gamer leagues. Yeah. It tends to fall back into cult status, not a major thing, and who gets excited about new operating systems anymore? And it all goes down to the fact that the entire industry pulled back from marketing. They're not marketing, not doing demand generation. Even Apple, who probably does more than anybody else, when's the last time you see Apple try to pitch a MacBook Air or something? In fact, right. It looks like they're turning their own PCs into cash cows, pulling back solidly from that particular segment. And so there's nobody really driving demand into it, and we've got people pushing TVs and people pushing cars, and we even have people pushing appliances. You watch a typical TV show, you'll see ads about all of that stuff. And yet you won't see a single thing with regard to pushing technology. And then people come back and say, well, those people don't really want to buy technology. Well, yeah, because nobody's really selling it to them. So the problem isn't that folks suddenly have decided to have a problem with PCs, because I think if any of us look around, most of the desks are covered with the damn things. It's a 300-plus million-unit market. But for some reason, there's this group think that says, yeah, well, nobody really wants to do that anymore.
Hmm. We're speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle. He wrote a piece called Why the PC Industry is Trying to Kill the PC. So who are the typical PC users today? So most of us at work?
Yeah, most of us at work. If you look at what people are using other than a PC, it's probably more smartphones than anything else. But in most cases, it's when they're mobile and running around. They're not really using their... because it's kind of hard to use a laptop when you're... when you don't have a desk in front of you. But when it comes to doing real work, people still pull out the laptop, or they have a desktop machine that they actually do their job on. It'll multitask. You can be on the web. You can be running a local application. I mean, things that a smartphone just doesn't do very well, and a tablet, for the most part, doesn't do at all. So the end result is still very viable.
Thanks, Rob. It's tech analyst Rob Enderle. It's 13 minutes before the hour on This Weekend.
You don't have to be a retail giant or government agency to be the victim of a costly data breach. If you run a website and collect customer data, your small to mid-sized business is just as likely to be targeted by hackers. The Barracuda Web Application Firewall provides cost-effective instant security against automated and targeted attacks, making this WAF a must-have for your SMB. Reclaim your network. Try a Barracuda Web App Firewall risk-free at barracuda.com/WAF.
So summer vacation isn't too far off, right? This year, there are more options than ever to have your dog stay in an upgraded place while you're away, perhaps a McMansion or a penthouse loft, and it could cost less than you'd normally pay to board him. Market Watch reporter Katie Hill has a look at those and other options for pet care when the family goes on vacation. Katie, like what?
Okay, the first thing is basically this is like Airbnb for your dog. Your dog could go stay in someone else's house, usually someone that's already a pet owner. They have another dog to play with often at the house. There's two sites that do this, big ones, DogVacay and Rover.com, and they work just very similarly to how Airbnb works, but instead of you staying in the house, your dog does.
Oh, interesting. All right, so is that like a negotiable rate, or is that typically a set rate?
Usually, like Airbnb, they put the rate that they want, but you can always contact the host and see if maybe they could drop it down. But you can search by price on that, so you could find, you could really rent a mansion on this for your dog. If you want your dog to stay in Beverly Hills, well, there's right. probably someone who's on there, or you can go, one-bedroom apartment, more like what he's used to.
Oh, my goodness. How about that? All right, what else is out there?
Pet-friendly home swap. So, again, this is, these sites like Love Home Swap, HomeExchange.com. You can look for pet owners on those, say, hey, let's swap homes, and I'll also take care of your pet. And there's a filter on Love Home Swap where you can say pet-friendly, which is an interesting option. Someone, you leave your house, you swap homes with someone else, and they'll take care of your dog, and you take care of theirs.
How about that? That's good stuff. I like that. That's a good
one.
Yeah,
strange, but it works.
I talked
to people who did this, and they said, oh, we love it. I don't have to go. I don't have to board my dog. The person I'm swapping homes with is just going to take care of him for me.
I often tell my wife, it'd be cheaper just to fly our dogs on vacation with us with the amount of money we pay to have someone take care of them. It's crazy.
It's crazy. I mean, especially as you're in the New York area. It's crazy.
Yeah. Wow. We're speaking with MarketWatch reporter Katie Hill. Her piece is called Rent a Mansion This Summer for Your Dog, and she's got a piece on different places dogs can stay if you find that boarding is too expensive. All right, so what else?
So So if you are going to have a house sitter anyway, some sites, trustedhousesitters.com is one that I found. A lot of them will take care of your pets too, and that they don't even charge extra. They, I mean, some people love it. They love having, you know, a dog to play with. So that's another option for people who are going to have a house sitter anyway. Just have them come in, take care of the dog for you.
Wow. What's a doggy co-op?
This was the most interesting one. I talked to someone who created a doggy co-op. So this is basically a bunch of dog owners in the neighborhood who get together and they swap services. So if one of them is going to be running late from work, they call someone in the co-op, or they usually have a joint email, you know, listserv kind of thing. And they say, hey, can someone run over and, you know, feed my dog? Or when they go out of town, they say, hey, can you watch my dog? I'll watch yours when you go out of town. But it's really just a group of people who all own dogs, either in the same apartment building or in the same neighborhood. And they all kind of agree to watch each other's dogs or feed them when someone's running late or something like that.
Thanks, Katie. Market Watch reporter Katie Hill, who's based in New York. It is 6 minutes now before the hour on this weekend. In and near Milwaukee, some people are getting a little faith with their froth. It's a story from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. It says assemblages like Jesus and beer are part of a national trend of groups combining Bible study with elbow bending. It's apparently an idea that goes back to Martin Luther and the Protestant Reformation. Brandon Brown, pastor at Collective MKE Church, says he started Jesus and Beer because, quote, people have left traditional church structures but still want to talk about Jesus. Steve Jerby, pastor at All People's Lutheran Church, says the Reformation was funded by brew that was made by Martin Luther's wife. Pastor Jerby hosts a monthly meeting at the River West Public House where people of all faiths or no faith drink beer and talk religion. Participants are asked to join in spirited debate, but to never use violent words or actions. Sloppy drunkenness is not tolerated, according to the laminated cards that Mr. Jerby hands out. That'll do it for this program. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Give your employees the power to do their best work. Reduce downtime by 50% and boost productivity with 4 times faster performance by updating to the most secure, manageable, and reliable Dell Latitude business class laptops and 2-in-1s with the latest Intel Core processors. Give your employees the power to do their best work. Learn more at Dell.com/radio. That's Dell.com/radio.